My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome to episode 17 of Mysteries and Monsters. This week we are joined by author and investigator Denver Michaels to discuss his book Water Monsters South of the Border. We take a journey into the deepest, most remote areas of South America, discussing some jaw-dropping stories about terrifying creatures. It seems there are more things than anacondas, killer bees and piranhas to keep our eyes open for. But before we get there, don't forget you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also support us through Patreon at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. And finally, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher or whichever podcast app you use and share us far and wide. Now, let's go monster hunting. Today I'm delighted to welcome author Denver Michaels to Mysteries and Monsters. Denver has released several books so far, indulging in his love of cryptozoology and the paranormal. And today we'll be diving into one of my favourite subjects, aquatic monsters. In his book Water Monsters, South of the Border, Denver takes us on a fascinating tour of South and Central America, Mexico and the Caribbean to look at the rich histories of monsters thought to inhabit regions all across these areas. Denver, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, here we are. How on earth did you, what caused you to dive into this subject that can take over many a person's life?
Well, it's just been one of those kind of a lifelong fascination, really, since I was a kid. As a young kid, I was into the paranormal topics and, just really all those offbeat kind of weird topics and things like that. And I kind of got interested, in lake monsters as a late teen and kind of grew from there, sea serpents and that sort of thing. And, it's just one of those, as far as cryptozoology goes, I always really liked this topic, because to me, lake monsters, sea serpents, that's the one thing, maybe not one thing, but to me, that's the creatures that have the biggest chance of being actually real flesh and blood creatures. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's a lot for, Bigfoot and that sort of thing. I mean, there's a lot of inconclusive evidence out there, but to me, like, lake monsters and sea serpents, they could literally be hiding in our waters because there's just so much water out there.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with what you're saying there, because it's the one thing that's always attracted me to that particular branch of cryptozoology. It's simply the fact that we know hardly next anything about deep sea, and the amount of water on the planet, it just seems as though something could be hiding somewhere. And we've come across situations over the years. I mean, obviously the megamouth shark is a prime example of a creature that just appeared from absolutely nowhere. And I think that was only filmed in 95. So that's another, whenever something like that turns up, it just adds more, not necessarily proof, but it certainly strengthens the argument that the depths of the seas and the lakes around the world clearly can be inhabited by creatures that we've no idea what on earth these things are.
And there's just such vast regions, in places like Africa and South America. There's just these just such vast regions with so much water, that's really virtually unexplored. And even even in North America and the lakes there, I mean, there's plenty of people that go to them, but these things are so deep and so large, just and there's just so many of them. And like if you take Bigfoot for instance, I mean, there's thousands of people out looking for Bigfoot every weekend in the woods and all that. But as far as these lake monsters and things, it's not as easy of a creature to try to get your evidence of. You're so limited, there's just these vast areas of water, and it's expensive to try to do any meaningful field research. And so to me, there could just be so many of these things, really right under our nose.
I mean, I'm a massive fan of the show River Monsters and Jeremy Wade in general, Denver. I mean, I've watched that show for everything he's done over the last 10, 11 years. And some of the creatures he's, these are normal creatures that we all have heard of, from catfish to giant rays to eels all around the world. And some of the creatures he finds, in fairly well populated areas, are absolutely mind-blowing. So you even talk about something as I say as normal as a giant catfish, but you look at the sizes that some of those creatures get to, and they live in well-traveled bodies of water with big populations around it. A lot of pleasure boating goes on, canoeing, kayaking, and yet these giants are there just swimming around under the surface meters from people. So it's intriguing that despite the physical evidence, because Wade's he's a damn good fisherman as well, because he catches a lot, people still think, oh, well, we it's that kind of, well, we've discovered everything we need to discover now. And I just can't get my head around that, especially when we're talking about aquatic-based situations, because there's vast realms of the world that are completely unexplored.
And in the Amazon alone, I was looking at this a couple of years ago, and I believe I read, and this was like in like a mainstream scientific publication, but I want to say that like maybe it was either every other day or either two species a day or one species every other day. I can't remember which it was, but it's being discovered in the Amazon. So, I mean, that's on the low end, if it's one species every other day, I mean, that is still just staggering to think about. And usually these are insects or small fish or things like that. But that just shows you that, I mean, there is so much out there that we don't know about our planet and about the creatures that are here. And having been to South America, a few years ago, I traveled to Peru, and went into the Amazon and stayed at one of those eco lodges. It's like a 4-hour boat ride into there, and did some exploring around. And I mean, it just strikes you, it just there could literally be anything in there.
Well, I mean, they're still coming across tribes of people out there that have had no contact with the outside world at all. So if a population of breeding people can avoid detection for generations and decades, we're talking about creatures considerably smaller in, land-based especially. So that alone strengthens that argument. Well, if people can survive undetected, the realms of possibility are endless.
And especially, with how much water there is. I mean, there are just so many, in that part of the world, there's, these big swamps, and I mean, they're almost impenetrable. And there's, in the rivers, there's just these, just like these massive depths. I think in some of the rivers, there'll be depths of, over 100 feet in places, and it just really blows your mind at what could be in there. And then, you hear, a lot of the tales, and it's a lot of the indigenous tales of things that live in the jungles and in the swamps. And you read the old stories of, from explorers like Percy Fawcett and Leonard Clark and some of those guys, and just it makes you think, man.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, so what was it that made you think, right? Because to be fair, I think this is probably an area of the world that we don't tend to bother with that much these days. As you refer to there, Percy Fawcett and Leonard Clark and the like. At the turn of the 20th century, South America seemed to be the last great unexplored continent, especially in the Amazon. And yet it seems, as we've come into the modern era, that people have kind of gone, well, I don't think there's much value in continuing that. And I find that perplexing. So what was it that made you think South America is ripe for a book on this subject? Because I think it's a very underreported kind of phenomena down there, because once you look into your book, Water Monsters of the South, these stories seem to come from all over the place. That it seems to be every country in South and Central America has some kind of weird creature inhabiting water.
Well, and you know what? That is exactly why I wrote the book, because I felt that that part of the world really doesn't get the attention that it deserves as far as cryptids go. I mean, but because of how unexplored it is, how vast a region and how impenetrable it is. And I just being somebody that's involved in this topic and field, it's like I just never really read a whole lot about a whole lot of the stories, because it's really just underreported. So I my first book I wrote about lake monsters in North America, and like one of the things I kind of wanted to do was kind of research that part of the world and find out, down there, do they have the same kind of lake monsters and things like that that we have up here? And I kind of went from there. And it's a small book. It's kind of hard to to get real in depth on it, but if I could speak Spanish or read Spanish real well, I mean, I can read a little bit. I can I can order a coffee at the airport, but that's about as good as I can get with it. So I'm kind of limited with the language barrier and that sort of thing. But it's there, with just with what I was able to do, I was just able to find a lot of reports of giant snakes and possible living dinosaurs. You read about some of these tales of water tigers, water bulls. There's just a lot of interesting stories.
Yeah, very much. I mean, do you think that's because most of these reports are in Spanish, that it is a very underreported phenomenon down there?
I mean, to me, that's got a lot to do with it. And also there's just not they don't have quite the populations that we do in the in the northern hemisphere. And it's you just these areas are just so vast. People just barely even penetrate these jungles and things. So a lot of what you're left with is just a lot of your reports from your old European explorers and whatever tales you can get from from newspapers and things like that, and hopefully get them translated into English on Google Translate or something like that, but I'd found I'd found a newspaper, like an old Reuters archived paper, and the headline, it, you know, kind of jumped out at me. What was it here? I got it wrote down. Okay, so this was from 1997. I think it's like August 1997. But the headline is "Monster-sized boa, two buses." Okay, monster-sized boa, size of two buses, terrified village. And it went on to tell about this massive, you know, they call it a boa, or which, you know, would be almost like people think of your, I'm using air quotes, mythical giant anaconda. You know,
yeah.
picture that movie that, who was Ice Cube and
Jennifer
Lopez.
Yeah.
Back in the day. You know, I mean, it's like the size of that. The article reported something 130 feet by 15 feet in diameter. And it was underground, and it just as it was traveling to the river, it just ripped up this big swath of land and uprooted trees. You know, the earth shook. Several witnesses reported seeing it, and you know, it was just amazing. Of course, you know, later in the article, experts were, you know, like kind of laughing about it, you know, wouldn't take it seriously and things, but there's several reports from recent memory, you know, down in that part of the world. That was in Peru,
yeah.
And I'd run across a few of those kind of things.
I mean, it does seem, you know, when you look at the book and go through it, and like you refer to there, Peru seems to be a real hotspot. Out of all the countries that you mention, it seems Peru seems to be the hotspot for these giant boa stories. I know there's a few references to giant anacondas in Brazil, but, you know, looking at that, and like you refer to, the historic stories that tend to come forward about these giant boas, a lot of them do seem to be based in Peru, don't they?
Yeah, that's, you know, like you said, seems to be one of the hot spots. And, you know, I did, like, kind of like on the Peru, you know, maybe close to the Bolivian border. And you know, like back in the day, if you read a lot of, if you read Percy Fawcett's old writings, that's a lot of the area that, you know, he was, mapping out, I guess, for the Royal Geographic Society or whoever it was. And, you know, he had a lot of tales, you know, from that part of the world. But yeah, there's, I can think of like, you know, another one, and I want to say that this might have been 2004-ish or somewhere in there, maybe 2009, I can't remember. But, you know, a lady, you know, she had a house, like the houses they have that are like up on stilts, you know, because of the water. One where, and this, there was a newspaper article. I can't remember the paper that ran it now, but the headline had like "Sachamama," like in exclamation points. And, anyway, like supposedly one of these giant, you know, they called it a giant boa, that had actually destroyed her house, like supposedly pushed it, you know, over 200 yards. And, you know, you just hear like all of these things, and it makes you scratch your head.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting report as well, because they'd seen this kind of island of detritus and debris near their house and hadn't really thought much of it, had they? And then they'd had a few incidents. I think they'd heard large banging on the stilts of the house, and it seemed as though something was deliberately knocking it on occasion, until it obviously culminated in this attack that basically knocked the house off its foundations and sent it flying.
Yeah, you know, apparently, you know, there was like this island of debris, and you know, I guess it just kept, like, kind of kept getting closer and closer. And one of the things, I think the lady's name was, I think it was Dolores Shuna, and she kept saying that that they were smelling around, you know, around the house, a real strong odor of what she said, like boa urine. And, you know, I've got no idea what boa urine smells like, but I'll just take her word for it. But, you know, so it was like really strong. And, yeah, and that, I guess that preceded the attack. And so, I don't know if, you know, if this thing, it just, you know, maybe the house had encroached on it, on its territory. I don't know how long the house, you know, I don't have enough background to know if, you know, if this house had been, you know, recently, you know, put up there, and if it had, if the people had just encroached on its territory, or if this giant snake had, you know, moved into the area. I'm not sure, you know, but I've read of at least one more report of like these floating islands of debris that these massive snakes could just push around. I mean, they're it's truly it's really terrifying to think about too.
Absolutely. You know, I'm, like you refer to her description there. Now, I've got a couple of friends who keep reptiles and snakes, and I'll say one thing: if you've never smelled snake urine, once you've smelled it, you never forget it. It's what you could call extremely pungent, shall I say? So it's like really, really strong ammonia. It make, like, makes your makes your eyes sting, and makes your throat. But it's not a pleasant experience. I doubt it'll be used for aftershave, I'll say that much.
Well, that's probably why she mentioned it in the article, because you know, if it does smell that bad, and then you've got one, you know, say 50, 100 feet long, I mean, I guess that would you know, be something that you would definitely take note of.
Absolutely, I think that'd certainly leave a rather large aroma. I think something of that size, definitely. But yeah, it's interesting, especially when you come to giant snakes, because you know we know that, you know, they exist in giant snakes that we accept that still exist out there. You know, your rock pythons and your boa constrictors. I mean, even a king cobra. I mean, they can grow to 18 feet long, and they are terrifying when you see a full-grown king cobra. So, you know, and you look at the situation that's going on in Florida at the moment with the boa constrictor rock python invasion there. These always seem to be not beyond the realms of possibility to me, when it comes to large creatures. Snakes seem to be the one that I tend to gravitate towards as having a real foundation in truth.
Yeah, and I mean, and in these you know, in the jungles down there, these really hot tropical climates, you know, it's conducive for them to, you know, getting, you know, growing really large anyway. And you know, the snakes, as far as I know, their whole life they never stop growing. And you know, one of these large you know, giant snakes like that, I mean, let's face it, that's an apex predator. There's you know, there's nothing that's going to be preying on them, except, you know, they do say, or I've read that that they are cannibalistic. So, you know, that I guess they kind of keep their own population in check like that. I've read that these things can get so big that you know, they actually leave the water and, you know, go into the jungle, and you know, they're pretty much immobilized. They just get so large, and at that point they use pheromones to attract you know, these other large snakes and eat them.
Well, that's the other thing as well, because we know that snakes can go considerable periods of time without eating once they've gorged themselves on certain animals. And obviously, one of the strangest sights of my life, I went on holiday to Italy a few years ago, and we went golfing. And this may sound like a tangent, but I'll get to my point. Whilst we were there, we played on this lovely course in the middle of northern Europe. It was near Venice, so it was stunningly beautiful in May, gorgeous. And when we set off, the attendant said to us, "Oh, watch out for the capybaras." And I was like, "What? What What do you mean, capybaras? I'm in Italy, not South America. And there'd apparently been a fur farm in the area, and it had been raided in the 1990s by some animal rights activists, and they'd freed all these capybaras. And they'd taken residence on this golf course, and there was a breeding population, I think we saw about 40.
Wow.
Living on a golf course in northern Italy, living in the in a lake. Wasn't very big, this particular lake. I mean, it was a fairly sizable piece of water. But there was, you know, full-grown adults there. You're talking a four-foot rodent. And I'd never seen, obviously I'd seen them in a zoo on and on television. But I never expected in a million years to walk past one. I was, you know, 20 foot away. Now, anacondas eat those. And that alone should tell you enough about the size of what anacondas can get to. Because obviously that's obviously the largest snake that we're aware of on Earth at the moment. And yet stories of them reaching gigantic sizes are as well known as anything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's you're right. I mean, these things, it just kind of creeps me out thinking about, you know, how big these things are. And, you know, I mean, when I was down there, I talked to a guy, and I don't know how big of an anaconda, you know, they say, like, the record is, I think it's only like 20, well, only, in it's like 25 feet, but, yeah, he was telling me about one that he had taken a picture of, and, I think it was like, 27 feet thereabouts, and then he had told of, you know, I'd ask him, you know, about the, you know, the giant anacondas. I think they kind of where we were. They call them a yaku mama, or however you say it. Mm. And he had talked about his grandmother had saw one, and you know, because at first I kind of approached it kind of lightly, because, you know, he was talking about, you know, his pictures of the anacondas and things like that, and so I just kind of was like, you know, he might laugh at me here, but I'm going to ask him anyway. I'm like, so do you believe the you know, the yaku mama, do you believe that those are real? And, you know, he's like, oh yeah. And, you know, he told me about his grandmother. And, you know, the way that the stories go is these things, yeah, that they can hibernate, you know, for long periods of time, and, you know, they burrow under the ground, and, you know, when they wake up, they go to the nearest body of water, and they're so big that it's almost like seismic activity, almost like an earthquake if you're around. And that's what he talked about, was that she said that the earth shook, and that, you know, that the river actually shook, and, you know, he made a motion with his hands, you know, how they did, and it was just incredible to, you know, to hear somebody, you know, recount that, and, you know, the descriptions he gave, you know, what his grandmother saw was, I mean, they were consistent with, you know, with all the things you read about, and it was, you know, it was pretty fascinating.
Mm. I mean, the other tantalizing aspect of this is the famous incident from Africa. I know we're jumping continents, but the Belgian pilot Remy van der Leer, who photographed that enormous snake when he was flying over the Congo in the 1950s. I mean, that's never been disproven. I mean, that's a terrifying picture still to this day.
Yeah.
And you know, I've seen many a documentary and program about the anaconda and the large snakes of South America. They are terrifyingly large.
Yeah.
They are not something I would, you know, I'm not surprised quite a lot of people live on houses on poles, to be fair. Because the last thing you want is something like that slithering through your front door.
Yeah, I mean, just the water there. I mean, you know, they've got certain parts of the jungles there. They've got those gigantic, you know, freshwater stingrays, and I mean, they're not aggressive, but if you step on one or something, they can, you know, put that barb in you. They've got caimans and, you know, these gigantic catfish, and just, there's just so many, so many things in the water there that I don't want anything to do with.
I mean, the stingrays especially. I know there was a very famous incident in the 90s there. I think it's a River Monsters episode actually, with the bride on her wedding day, and they decided to
Oh,
have
yeah.
some lovely pictures taken, stood in the river, and she stood on an array, and the barb went straight through her ankle, dragged her to her death.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, that's just terrifying to think about. And you know, they just blend right in with the mud, and you just, you know, just step on them, you know.
It's a dangerous place to be for the for even if for the residents there, you know. There are so many dangers both on land and in the water. It's one of those places where you sometimes consider the reasons why anybody would want to live in that kind of environment.
Yeah, I mean, and just the you know, the diseases from you know, just a mosquito bite and things like that. You know, a lot of the people there have to deal with you know, potentially getting these parasites and things just from mosquitoes. And there's just so many just things that, you know, that we take for granted that these people have to deal with. I mean, it's a hard climate. You know, you got the dry and rainy season, and you know, the challenges with that. And yeah, it's definitely a hard place to live. We you know, we're definitely kind of spoiled, but on the other hand, you know, there's something about those wild places like that are, you know, just so you know, so fascinating. And you know, it's just amazing that there are those places like that still.
Yeah, and I think it just taps into the thirst for exploration that several people from all around the world have indulged in, you know, from scaling the highest mountain to, you know, as we're currently trying to find the, you know, getting to the bottom of the oceans and you know, the Marianas Trench and places like that. I always view such people as both incredibly foolish but braver than I could even possibly contemplate, Denver.
Yeah, and especially, and I know that you know, that a lot of the early European explorers and you know, even into the early 1900s, I mean, they get a lot of flack. They really didn't do things the right way with, you know, with the native peoples and things like that. But you know, that aside, the that spirit of exploration and you know, going into these jungles and things where, you know, they don't have the you know, moisture wicking clothing like that I wear when I go hiking. They don't have the, you know, the good boots that I do, and they don't, you know, they don't have the insect repellent, you know, and things like that. You know, you just think of these simple things that I take for granted, you know, just when I go on a hike to keep ticks off of me and things. And you know, they didn't have any of that. They, you know, nobody had been there before where they went. And I am just fascinated. I'd love to read the old, you know, the old stories of, you know, guys like Percy Fawcett and, you know, Captain Cook, you know, these kind of people. And, you know, even though, you know, a lot of these guys are frowned on these days, you know, 'cause again, they didn't necessarily treat the indigenous peoples, you know, in the way they always should. But it's still, you know, that spirit of adventure. I just love to read about that.
Yeah, I mean, Fawcett's a very strange individual. Well, not a strange individual, but it's quite peculiar that a man who made his name through his exploration and searching for mysterious things ended up becoming one of the most mysterious disappearances of the 20th century.
Yeah, and I mean, even to this day, I mean, we really don't know what happened to him. And you know, you read a lot of the old newspaper reports from the day. You know, there were people that I forget the guy's name, but had claimed that he was alive, you know, many years later, that Perhaps he had been taken captive, but was still alive, and there were, various expeditions out looking for him and things like that. But I mean, we really don't know what happened. I mean, he could have just, and his son, and I believe his son's friend were with him, and they all disappeared, and it's one of those mysteries that we'll never know.
Yeah, I think it's up there with Amelia Earhart, to be fair, as probably the most famous disappearance of the 20th century up there, really.
It really is. But yeah, he, I mean, and but I love to read about about his old stories, and I mean, he's got tales of like of dinosaurs in the in the jungles, and or possible dinosaurs. A lot of people would scoff at that, but there are a lot of reports in that part of the world of saurian dinosaur-like creatures, and it's who knows.
I mean, it is quite interesting because I know there's obviously it kind of mirrors the stories of Mekele and Mbembe that come from Africa as well in regards to that kind of small population, because they're not everywhere, these stories of sauropods. They tend to be in a, once again, it is a specific region, whereas if which for me gives it more of a grounding in some kind of incident or witness report. Because if these stories were just made up or fables or whatever, they tend to be all over the place. Whereas these particular creatures, when we're discussing the water monsters of South America, seem to be based in a particular region.
Yeah, like your reports of the dinosaurs from there. I mean, most of those that I've read about come from kind of like the Bolivian, Peruvian kind of border regions there, where it's just real dense jungles, almost impenetrable, real swampy, and like in the early 1900s, a couple of German explorers, I think Hermann Schmidt and Rudolf Fling, they apparently supposedly shot at one of these dinosaur-like creatures. It was supposedly about 35 feet long, and I don't know if that's, I'm assuming that's kind of like head to tail. So something really, really big, and from what the stories say, the bullet didn't have any effect on the animal. And I mean, that kind of makes sense. If it were a dinosaur-like creature, they would have a real thick, real thick hide that would be hard to penetrate. But that was in the real swampy, dense areas, and the descriptions kind of the land there kind of matches, where you hear, Mekele and Mbembe, in the real dense, swampy areas in Africa there.
I mean, it's and that's that once again. I mean, it's the same with Mekele and Mbembe. That is in a specific region. It's not all over the place. It is in one particular area where people are adamant that these creatures have existed for a long time. I know Roy Mackal was probably the most famous person that spent his career desperately searching for the Mekele and Mbembe, and obviously he was the gentleman that took the book out there for the indigenous peoples to have a look at. And obviously they were flipping through books with hippos in and giraffes in, and they knew everything that they'd seen, and he showed them creatures that they hadn't seen before and they just ignored. And then they saw the sauropods and they went, yeah, that's it, that's what we've got here. So it beggars belief that we're expecting people without much contact at the time. I mean, it's like 50 years since Mikal started going out there, that they didn't have the internet. They probably had little or no access to encyclopedias or books. Dinosaurs were probably not something that these people had ever come across before.
And to think that they would just to just make all this up, I mean, it doesn't really make sense, and it's it it gives a lot of credence to the stories, I think, you know, when somebody puts a book out in front of them and they, you know, flips to a page and, oh yeah, that's it. You know, and they're pointing at it. And the stories, you know, like in South America, the indigenous people would tell of, you know, these long neck creatures that, you know, would flip canoes and were aggressive if they're approached. And, you know, there's just so many of these tales that, I mean, for me, it's hard to ignore. And I can't just totally dismiss things, even when they sound fantastic, because, you know, you just look at the available land that's out there and how little it's been explored. And to me, I mean, anything could be lurking in these areas.
I think that is one of the things I liked about your book as well, is that I mean, it's very easy when we're dealing with fantastical creatures to basically take everything on face value and accept it. And there's several stories and reports that you cover in your book that you basically say, "Nah, I'm not having that." And I think that also helps because, you know, when you're dealing with such alleged creatures and sightings of such, I think we have to try and balance it because, you know, I know, and there's some photos that have been published of certain creatures in the areas and stuff, and they look, you know, they're shockingly bad pictures, some of them. I'm trying to think which particular lake monster it is that there's some pictures, and it looks like a cardboard cutout at best, I think, is the nicest thing I can say about it, Denver. It's pretty poor. But I mean, when you look at certain areas, I mean, another fascinating area of South America is Patagonia, which is just, it's one of those places that's on my bucket list. I desperately want to go there because you know, it's full of fossils. There's a rich history of mysterious lights in the skies. But coupled with that, you've got a whole range of lake monsters that once again seem to inhabit a key component of these stories, which are glacial lakes.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what, you know, what I found, you know, when I first set out to write this book, you know, I wondered in South America, you know, if they had like the lake monsters that we have, and you know, like over in Europe that they have, and you know, like the Loch Ness monster and some of the creatures in the Irish lakes and in Scandinavia. And so what you find in South America, it's not really until you get into that Patagonian region, you know, where they have the glacial lakes, that you really find your, and I'm again using air quotes here, your typical lake monsters, you know, the things that are described kind of like the Loch Ness monster, you know, Champ, you know, what you would call like your you know, your plesiosaur type. You know, a lot of people don't believe a plesiosaur could be a lake monster, so I don't, you know, want anybody to yell at me, but that's kind of, you know, for lack of a better, you know, way of putting it, that's kind of what they sound like when they're described. And that's kind of what you find in Patagonia. A lot of the lakes there, you know, have these, I have had quite a few sightings, and they go back for quite a while. And, you know, you got one that's kind of nicknamed the Patagonian plesiosaur. And, you know, there've been a lot of reports from that part of the world and in those lakes there.
Yeah, that's probably the one I've heard of most. I think that's their most famous one. Is it Navaletto or
Yeah,
Navelito, I
I
think they
think that,
call
I don't know how to say the lake, but
it.
yeah, that's one of them. And there's some, I don't know, lakes not far away that, you know, that have had some reports. There's one, I think the creature's called the Huechelito, and it, you know, it's in one of those lakes down there, and that's been investigated and things like that. But a lot of those Patagonian lakes have had the sightings, and that's really what you find. I mean, there are some of the some of the lakes, like high in the Andes, have had couple sporadic reports of things. Like in Lake Titicaca, there have been your lake monster reports there. Yeah, a couple other places, but it's mostly those glacial lakes.
I mean, Titicaca is enormous. It is a vast expanse of water. It's almost as if it's like an inland sea. It is a phenomenal body of water down there, and it's quite high elevation as well. So it's a very unique area that would tend to be quite unique in an environmental manner, really, Denver, I think, because it's extremely unusual in comparison to other large lakes around the world.
It is, and I want to say that it's like the largest or the highest navigable body of water or thereabouts. I mean, I think it's like at 13,000 feet thereabouts, and there's a it's extremely deep. They've got these freshwater seahorses in there. There's just some wildlife that's kind of unique to that area. There's like sunken cities, ancient ruins and things in the water. There's UFO or USO reports, things like that. It's really a fascinating place, and it's on my bucket list. I've not actually got to go to Lake Titicaca yet, but it's on my bucket list. I really want to go there and spend some time.
Yeah, very much so. It's a fascinating, the whole area, like I said to you earlier. I mean, it's just a wonderful place. It's just jaw-dropping how incredible the environment down there is. And it's we've had a rich history of dinosaurs being found, fossils down there. So it seems enticing to me because of the unique environmental aspect of that whole area that, we keep finding creatures that aren't supposed to be where they're supposed to be, as we referred to Florida earlier. I mean, fish especially seem to be able to survive in wherever they're invasively introduced. You look at some of the problems that are happening in the States, with things like snakeheads and things like that. They just can just go wherever they want, and sometimes it seems that as though when you're dealing with these kind of subjects, people ignore scientific evidence and go, well, nothing large can exist in this body of water. Yet from countries all around the world, giant fish and eels and rays pop up all the time. And you look at some of the, you look at Lolong, who was the largest crocodile ever caught. I mean, these are phenomenally large creatures living next door to people.
Yeah, and especially, you think about places like South America and how these they have the warm water where fish and reptiles can really grow to these massive sizes. You don't have the you don't have quite the fishing pressure that you do in more populated places. And they're just a wealth of stories, from that part of the world of, giant catfish that, that actually, have eaten people. And, I think, Teddy Roosevelt was down in that part of the world and wrote of, these giant catfish that eat monkeys and things like that. And so you think about how frightening it is for fish large enough to eat monkeys and small children and even adults. There's stories of even adult males that have fallen prey to some of these giant catfish down there.
Well, the one thing we know about catfish is they will have a go at anything. They don't care. If it can fit in his mouth, it'll try and eat it. It's as simple as that.
And the thing with catfish, it's not like that they're really, They're not really an aggressive fish. I mean, they're not, it's not something that's really, looking to eat a human or attack a human, but they don't see very well. They kind of use their whiskers and that kind of attracts motion. So, if you got a small child or something, it's, kicking their feet in the water. They're attracted to that motion, that vibration. And then, they, see a foot flipping around, and it just looks like maybe a wounded bait fish or something, and they just grab it, and they're just so massive, it's all over after that. They drag you under the water and you drown. And it's hard to say how often that sort of thing happens, but there's a lot of those stories in that part of the world.
Yeah, and I think that's, at the end of the day, I mean, we all know the dangers of swimming in bodies of water, regardless, because, what you see on the surface, people ignore the underwater currents, the rip tides and things like that, even in a landlocked lake or such like. So for me, it's not, because we know how big catfish can get when they've got a regular food source. If you're a 6-year-old kid having a paddle 20 foot off the beach, if a 10-foot catfish sees a little kid having a paddle, it's gonna have a go at it, no problem, easy peasy.
Yeah, you're right. And even like from in Paraguay, there are these reports of, I forget how to say the name of the fish. I can't say half of these words in my book. I apologize. I can barely speak English, let alone these other words. But there's these reports of these the indigenous people talk about these giant fish that they're so big that they get up to, like 18 feet long, and that they just have all these tales where their dogs go in the water, and they eat the dogs, and again, like we're talking about small children, even have the occasional adult male that supposedly gets killed by these things. So, and it makes you think about. Kind of makes me think about how crazy these guys in Oklahoma are that
Oh,
go noodling.
dearie me. The first time I saw that, I think it was about 10 years ago, Denver, I saw, it might be another, once again, mentioning river monsters, I think, because Jeremy Wade goes and does it with him. And I was absolutely stunned. I was like blown away. Because I'd heard, obviously I knew what a catfish was how large they could get. But when you first come across noodling, it just blows your mind, because I mean, and it makes me speechless, because I can't get my head round it, because I'm not the best swimmer in the world anyway.
Yeah, and you using your arm for bait—that's just insane.
Yeah, that's not my kind of hobby. And and every through this, because it's a summer thing, and that certain areas have noodling competitions where you try and catch three, and then it's the overall weight, I think, is the general prize. But every year we hear stories of people drowning because they've got their arm caught in a catfish that they just can't noodle.
Yeah, and there's catfish, they kind of like hang out like in underhangs, under banks, and like under roots, and like down trees, so it'd be real easy to just kind of get pulled in like under those roots and stuff, and get kind of tangled up and drown real easy. And then I think too, with the noodling, the biggest thing that would kind of scare me about it, it's I mean, the catfish is one thing, and maybe I could kind of get past using my arm for bait for a catfish to clamp down on, but you're poking around under, you can't see what you're doing, And there's like the big snapping turtles and things
Oof.
like that, and there's water moccasins in that part of the world. So that's more what scares me, is it like a big old snapping turtle, taking my finger off or something like that.
Yeah, it's yeah. I think the more you talk about it, the worse the worst of a hobby it sounds, Denver, to be fair.
Yes.
And
I got
you,
better things to do, I
yeah,
think.
it's the kind of hobby I could suggest for some people I'm not very keen on to take up, but it's certainly one I'm going to stay away from. So yeah, I'm with you there. Yeah, it's just baffling. As weird hobbies go, we in the UK tend to think we've got some of the strangest pastimes that people take up, but that noodling is something I've no intention of ever wanting to do. So yeah, I mean, the other thing I found really interesting looking through your book and some of the stories I've seen is the references to what they call water tigers, which to all intents and purposes sound like saber-toothed tigers of some description.
Yeah, they really do. And the thing with the water tigers, this pretty much is continent wide. I mean, you get reports from French Guiana, out in Argentina, Colombia. It pretty much spans the entire continent, and different regions, kind of have their own names for them, but they're all pretty similar. Like a lot of the descriptions, from the 1700s, 1800s, from explorers or priests or missionaries in the area, they would talk about tusk like a walrus, sometimes described like the size of an ass, 10 feet in some cases, and yeah, I mean, they just sound like massive saber-toothed cats. But the thing that's kind of puzzling about it to me, because I've always thought that, maybe you've got something prehistoric that was supposed to have died off around the end of the last ice age, had maybe survived into the present day, like a Smilodon or whatever comes to mind. But the baffling thing, though, is you just have all these reports of, people, being attacked under the water, like cowboys or having their cattle going across, and cattle being attacked, or these things would, in a lot of the stories, like hide, under the water, like under a riverbank, and attack people and things like that. So that's the one thing that kind of gives me a little bit of pause about it, because, I can't really reconcile that with a big cat,
Yeah, because I mean, the only possible member of the big cat family that we have these days that could possibly be an explanation is a tiger, because tigers love water, which I think generally people's assumption of big cats is they tend to think of them as domestic cats, and everybody, most domestic cat owners, Denver, will tell you that cats will do anything to not get wet under any circumstances. But tigers seem to love it.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe there's a surviving remnant in this part of the world of, like an old these old saber-toothed cats that are supposedly extinct. I mean, that's what it sounds like in a lot of the cases. I mean, other explanations, people point to the giant otters, and they get pretty big, and I think that could be an explanation, maybe in some cases, but and I've heard that those can be aggressive. I don't, I don't have a whole lot of knowledge about their behaviors or that sort of thing, but to me, the I don't know, maybe a surviving type of saber-toothed cat kind of fits the bill in a lot of ways for these things. But there are tales from all over the continent, And I don't know about any like recent type reports of that activity. One that comes to mind is from French Guiana, and I think back in the 60s, a boy, his partially eaten body had washed up and had been examined by a doctor, and the wounds were consistent with with the descriptions of one of their water tiger legends or stories.
I mean, it is odd. I mean, it's one of those things, and I've spoken to a few people since I've started the show. When it comes to large cats being wherever they're not supposed to be, it seems to be everywhere. And the thing with South America is, it's one of the few places where we've got a population of mystery cats, where the people that live there know what a big cat looks like because they have them. So they clearly know what a big cat is, but the descriptions of this creature do not match what they know to be a big cat.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about these 12-inch long tusks, and that's what's described over and over with these things, that they've got tusks a foot long, and there's certainly no living cat that I know of in South America that has that. So I mean, but that's what they describe, and so it's hard to ignore all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I did see one skeptical analysis of this that essentially disproved it, because I think some witnesses have described finding webbed footprints, and they said, oh well, it's clearly not a real animal because a cat wouldn't have webbed feet. And I was thinking, well, there's a couple of breeds of dogs that have webbed feet. Why wouldn't a cat that lives in water have webbed feet?
Yeah, and I mean, you never know too. I mean, if you've got if you just got like one set of tracks like that, I mean, it could be, that could have been a cat with a deformity or something. Mm. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, I mean, what is it? Is it polydactyl? I mean, there's a few pictures we see of cats that are polydactyls. So, like you say, it could be a genetic thing, or it could simply be a genetic adaptation. If it's become used to its surroundings, it's not beyond the realms of possibility, you would suggest.
Yeah, and since we just don't have enough data, on these things. So I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, I just wouldn't be so quick to dismiss things just because it's something that we're not familiar with,
Absolutely. I think keeping an open mind at the best of times is always the best way to be, and that's sometimes why I get a little frustrated with some skeptical excuses, because half the time the excuses tend to be more ludicrous than the animals they're trying to disprove in some cases.
Oh yeah, I mean, you have that. I mean, that's the thing that frustrates me. It's like, okay, you can think I'm crazy because I believe in these weird creatures or whatever, but like, your explanation is way more crazy than anything I'm thinking of. But I mean, like my favorite thing is, when people see these big cats, in places where, say mountain lions or things that supposedly don't exist. So, they're kind of like the go-to is, you just saw a house cat, and you just thought it was bigger than it was. Okay, sure. Yeah, I'm mistaken, a tabby cat for a mountain lion. I'm so sure.
I mean, that's the other thing as well with situations like that, and you can kind of put that skeptical defense against a lot of people that see Bigfoot out there, is that these are experienced outdoors people. A lot of them are hunters. It's their living to identify creatures in woods and forests. They know what's what. And yet, when they report seeing these things, they're dismissed as if these guys, it's not their job to be out there in these remote areas looking for certain animals. And I always find that very, very odd, that these are people whose lives depend on their ability to identify animals, and yet they're dismissed completely out of hand, as you say, with excuses like, well, you've just seen a domestic cat. Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what something that always gets me too. Like you said, I mean, you know, a lot of your reports say, you know, and they're not coming, you know, from Bigfoot hunters. They're coming from deer hunters or things like that. People that, you know, they're out in the woods all the time. They know what a bear looks like. And you know, to just for somebody that, you know, never even gets outside, you know, to sit behind their computer and just dismiss it or make fun of it. That always kind of gets to me.
Yeah, it is a frustration, but it's one of those things that applies to, I think, every aspect of the paranormal, or cryptozoology or Fortiana in general, Denver, that there seems to be a ready-made bag of excuses, and it's always played out regardless of what's supposed to have been witnessed by someone.
Yeah, and you know, there's just a subset of people that they're not going to believe anything no matter what. And I get this all, I get frustrated all the time. So I'll get somebody, they'll be like, okay, well, everybody's got a cell phone in their pocket that has a camera and video. So how come there's no pictures of this? All right. So then you show them a picture, right, that someone sent you. Yep. Well, that's blurry and that's no good. That doesn't count. You know, so they're always moving the goalposts.
Yeah. Oh.
I'm sure you ran across the same thing, you know.
Very much so. As someone that's had a couple of strange experiences in my life, there is no skeptic that can tell me what I saw wasn't what I saw. But, you know, they're not interested. I know what I saw. I know what I witnessed. That's that. But it's still, you know, like a standard go-to, you know, when we talk about UFO. I mean, even in the, you know, as I was speaking to a couple of people over the last couple of weeks, the whole conversation about UFOs seems to have changed officially, and yet people are still adamant nothing's going on. It's nonsense. And I'm just thinking, what do you want as proof to actually get you on side in regards to what's going on, regardless of what strange phenomena it is? You know, as you say, Denver, you give them proof, they want something else. You give them something else. It's like Bigfoot. Unless somebody turns up with a body, nobody's going to take it, despite thousands and thousands of footprints. And John Keel was a prime example of this, as well as Ivan Sanderson, that always said, when skeptics said to him, oh, it's just people mucking about or it's a hoax. And he's like, well, so what you're expecting me to believe is that someone has driven into the middle of the American wilderness, miles from anywhere, and placed some random footprints in somewhere people do not go, and then just hope for someone to find him. I mean, that is as ludicrous as suggesting, well, it's probably more ludicrous to suggest that there's an unknown hominid running around North America, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The excuses are more ridiculous than, you know, than the claims, you know, in a lot of cases. And everybody's got their built-in excuse. I mean, I'm sure you've run across this. I mean, owls get blamed for everything, even Bigfoot sightings, you know. Yes. You'd be like, oh, it was just an owl on a tree, and somebody mistake that for Bigfoot. I mean, it's just like, owls get picked on constantly by skeptics.
Well, Mothman is the owl, is owls and sand cranes.
Yeah, you know, and that can probably account for some sightings. I mean, I will say, I mean, if I saw a sandhill crane in the middle of the night, like here where I live, where we don't have them, yeah, I mean, yeah, that might kind of freak me out and make me you know, kind of make me think that I saw something, you know, a cryptid or something paranormal. But it doesn't explain hundreds of sightings, and it doesn't explain, you know, something that can fly 75 miles an hour, keeping pace with your car, you know?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's the same in the UK, because obviously our largest domestic bird is the heron. which is quite similar in stature to a crane. And if you, and I remember once working with a lady, and we used to have a stunning heron, about 4 foot tall. Used to come and fish in a stream by the office I worked at, and she'd never seen a heron before. She was absolutely terrified. And it was just, I'm thinking, it's just a heron, but she'd never seen one before. As far as she was concerned, she'd spent 30 years of her life in the UK with never seen such a creature before, and the first time she saw it, it terrified her. And yet it's a fairly placid creature. It's quite happy just wandering about in a river just picking up fish, but that blew her mind, Denver.
No, I mean, some of these things that, you know, that you don't really run across, they could put a scare in you. And, you know, so, and that's what I kind of like my personal theory with cryptozoology, paranormal, what have you. Probably, you know, 90% of things can probably be explained by this or that, but there's always that, you know, 5-10% that you just cannot explain. You can't blame it on an owl. You can't blame it on a crane or a dog or a bear. So what are those, you know?
Yeah, I think that is, you know, very true, especially in this day and age when, unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, because for me, I think we're probably in a golden age of cryptozoology at the moment, because there's such an opportunity for anybody at any point in the world to just go on YouTube and they can just find video after video after video of any particularly strange creature that they're fascinated with. But we'll always have people that will take advantage of that kind of scenario by promoting fake footage or whatever. Mm. Because, you know, if you've got a channel on YouTube with so many subscribers, you are monetized, and therefore it becomes in certain individuals' financial benefit to push that kind of situation. But it still leaves us, like you referred to there, 5 or 10% of stories and reports and witnesses and videos and pictures of things that should not be where they've been taken.
Yeah, and you know, like you said, I kind of like the time that we're living in now. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I'd love to, you know, on my phone, you know, as long as I got service or a Wi-Fi connection, I can look anything up. You know, I don't have to, you know, like when, you know, I'm 45 years old, so I'm old enough to remember the old days that if I needed to look something up bad enough, you know, I'd have to drive to the library. Yep. You know, you'd have to spend, you know, half a day just getting, you know, just a couple paragraphs of information that you needed. But now, you know, you can look it up on your phone. It's nice. You can, you know, you've got all of this information at your fingertips. But it is a double-edged sword, because there is, you know, more there's more bad information out there. So you really have to use discernment, and there's more opportunities. You know, it was fairly easy in the 60s and 70s and even in the 80s and 90s, you know, it was pretty easy to spot a fake video or a fake picture. Now, I mean, to me, I don't even know, as far as videos and pictures, I'll usually just say, well, that's interesting, but I can't even, you know, count that as evidence anymore, because I'm not someone, you know, that has the knowledge of, you know, faking things. You know, I'm not a graphic artist or anything like that. So I just can't, a lot of fakes are so good that it takes someone that's like a graphic artist to be able to determine if it's a fake or not. So, but, you know, the biggest thing to me, the best evidence is, and will always be, the eyewitness testimony, because I just figure all of these people can't be lying.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, it's a constant theme that, you know, a lot of these witnesses, regardless of which cryptid they claim to have seen, will more often than not get absolutely destroyed by the, by the general press in public. I mean, obviously we've seen a bit of a change in regards to the UFO or UAP phenomenon over the last 18 months, but the rest of these weird subjects tends to be the standard. Always, they just want to make money. They just want to be famous. It's, you know, they're just after their 15 minutes of fame. Yes, there are cases of like that. Some very notable footage and things that are clearly awful.
Yeah.
But you know, once again, these people, in the vast majority of situations, have nothing to gain by coming forward.
No, nothing at all. And I mean, and you know, these people come from all walks of life, every education level. You get police officers, engineers, nurses, you know, just every occupation, every walk of life, you know, every race, every, you know, male, female, you know, it just runs the gamut. So, and there's really nothing to be gained by coming forward with a sighting. And, you know, you do really, put yourself out to, a lot of ridicule and things like that. And, it's getting a little better as far as UFOs. I mean, at least, like just over the last couple of years, you know, you see how it used to be on the news, how it would always be at the end of the night, and, you know, the anchors would be. And on a lighter note, we've got a flying saucer report. And, you know, so now it's actually, you see it, you know, on CNN, Fox News, NBC, on the websites, you know, with like actual stories that, that they're not poking fun at. So things are getting a little better in that regard with UFOs, but there's still a pretty big stigma on, you know, someone coming forward and reporting a Bigfoot sighting or, a black cat sighting where one shouldn't be, or, you know, Mothman, what have you. There's still a lot of stigma on that. And, you know, hopefully that gets a little bit better, but you know, it's just, it comes with the territory, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's always nice to see a news report about anything weird that does not feature the X-Files theme.
Yeah, like, but that, that's kind of the go-to, you know. Like, well, tonight we've got some flying saucer, and then
Little Green Men, tinfoil hats, X-Files theme. That's your go-to, you know, typical local news report. So thankfully we're moving away from that. So yeah.
It is a little bit better.
It is. So what's next for you, Denver? What are you working on? What you got planned for your next book?
Well, I'm going to have a book coming out fairly soon. I think July 22nd, I believe, is when the Kindle version will drop, and the paperback will be sometime around there. Anyway, the name of the book is El Paso to Las Cruces via Roswell, and it just kind of chronicles some of my travels in that part of the world, and I look at cryptid reports from the Southwest, and, you know, some paranormal things. And I don't get too heavy into the UFOs, but, talk briefly about it. It's just, kind of a fun book, chronicling, some of the things I've been doing.
Fantastic. Now, are you working on anything currently for another release, or have you got a subject that you've wanted to dive in and devote a book to at all, Denver?
Well, I'm just kind of been doing a lot of traveling, and locally here, I've kind of been devoting myself to trying to get some pretty good proof that mountain lions are roaming around in Virginia and West Virginia, and I've kind of dove into that quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that is something I'm really into, because obviously the UK has had reports of alien big cats, as we call them over here, ABCs, for going back 40-50 years. And it continues unabated. You know, obviously the most famous one's probably the Beast of Bodmin, but we've got them reported in Scotland, in Wales, in Ireland, all over the UK, and they still continue. And I was speaking to a gentleman the other week called Alexander Petikoff, who's also currently doing a film called Lions of the East, which is exactly about that subject. It looks a fascinating documentary that he's doing. But that's exactly the same kind of thing, Denver. It's, you know, especially, you know, when you're talking about the States, you have big cats out there, you know, in comparison, certainly far bigger than anything we've got this side of Europe. And yet it seems to be a complete disregard by the authorities that these creatures are out there completely, despite, once again, hunters, you know, outdoors people, numerous witnesses from states all across the US reporting seeing large cats that officially do not exist or are extinct.
Well, what really got me, you know, of course I'm interested in, you know, anything weird but you know, like mountain lions, right? I mean, so that's something we know that they exist, and we know that they, you know, they used to be all over, you know, the East Coast of the United States, and, you know, they kind of got hunted, I don't think to extinction, but, you know, so this is something that, this isn't something that we have to prove ever existed, like Bigfoot or something like that, you know. So what really kind of got me on this kick was, I want to say it was like September 17, thereabouts. Anyway, there had been, in Virginia where I live, and especially down around the Roanoke area, down that way, there had just been a lot of reports of mountain lions. And in the Virginia Department of Game and Fish, they came out and said, and they, I mean, they actually issued a statement on it, like, I don't remember exactly what they said, but there's no mountain lions in Virginia. Da, 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 da. And I'm like, oh, really? You know, because there had always, you know, like the Shenandoah National Park. I mean, there's just always been reports there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and their big thing to back up their claims was always, you know, if there were mountain lions here, we'd see more that have been hit by cars. And, you know, I can kind of give them that, but the thing is, you know, all of these people are not, you know, they're not just seeing a bobcat, right? I mean, you know, the bobcats and mountain lions are, I mean, they're just, the size is totally different. And so a lot of, like your hiking, websites, you know, places where people give reviews and things of hikes, you know, people will just, you know, casually just say, oh, I saw a mountain lion. So, you know, there's really, that's not something that's real sensational, or there's really no reason for somebody to just lie and say that, you know. So I've kind of tried, you know, been to a lot of those places, and back in March, I was up on the West Virginia, Virginia line in the National Forest. And I found, you know, literally dozens of mountain lion tracks. And so that really, really got me even more excited about it. And I've got an area, I've kind of narrowed it down to, you know, maybe about 10, 15 square miles. And I've found what I believe to be a mountain lion droppings and scat and that sort of thing. So I'm just looking for more and more and more proof to really, you know, try to kind of at least prove that, you know, either we have a population here. 'Cause I don't think it's just like a random one passing through, I guess is what I'm getting at. I think that we have, you know, a small population of them here. And I'm really, trying to document as much as I can.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I look forward to seeing that when it comes out, Denver, and we'll hopefully have a chat about that sometime.
Yeah, hopefully I'll have some more proof.
Yeah, well, all power to you, my friend, all power. So, before I let you go, where can everybody find your work, follow you online, and if they're interested in buying the fabulous books that you've released, where can they get them?
Yeah, I'm on, just go on Amazon. I've got an Amazon page. I've got four books available, and I've got a new one available for pre-order. DenverMichaels.net is my website. You can look up author Denver Michaels. I've got a Facebook page, a YouTube channel, and you can look me up on Twitter as well.
Awesome. Well, brilliant. Like I say, I absolutely love water monsters. It's a real thing. So thank you so much for taking the time today to have a chat about weird monsters from South America and beyond and other things. As I said, we ended up going on a couple of tangents, but you went with me, so thank you.
Well, I appreciate you having me. It's a lot of fun.
Hey, well, listen, thanks again for your time today, Denver. You take care, and we'll speak again soon. All the best.
All right, thank you.